Listeners, today we're going to be talking about, well, I can attest to the fact that there is such increased concern for information about veganism that I'd say probably the number of vegan slanted cookbooks or books that I get has quadrupled in the past few years, a couple of years actually.
And one of the contributors is with us today.
Yes, Nina Guilbeault, which is French, but she's from Moldova, right, Nina?
That's right. I'm from Moldova, but I grew up in Canada, and my last name is French-Canadian now, my husband's name.
Okay. All right. You did grow up in Canada. And,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And your trip, or voyage, I guess I could say, on the path that led you to become a vegan, it's very complicated. It took a while. And you document some of that in this book, but listeners, you're also going to learn things that you never even thought you had to ask about, where veganism comes from, how far back does vegetarianism come from, what are the central issues. It's just packed with information, Nina, and you did an absolutely splendid job of explaining it all. Now, let's do a little bit of background on your history. I mean, you are a certified academic, by all counts, with your doctorate from Harvard and all your other studies and your teaching experience. You really, the whole time I'm reading this cookbook, or this book, I wouldn't call it a cookbook, this book, I'm thinking, how daunting it would be to attack a subject for which there are so many possible answers, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
You conclude that there's no one answer really, but there is an answer, isn't there?
Well, I mean, there is the answer is, you know, eat more wholesome plants and, you know, really focus on eating more from the plant kingdom and eating as much as you can reduce animal products off your plate. That's really the answer. But as I say in the book, that really is the start of the journey rather than the end of the journey, because the food system is so incredibly complex. And as you say,
yes.
You know, it was daunting to write this book. I thought that after writing a dissertation that, you know, I could write a book and it would be quite a smooth process to go from academic work to writing this book. But in this book, what really interested me is this question, which is really at the heart of the book, which is there an ethical way to eat? You know, because the vegan movement, and as you say, it spans back all the way to antiquity, there is an answer, which is don't eat animals. And I am a vegan myself, philosophically, I also believe in that. But really, there are so many other components of the food system, the human ethical element as well, like how slaughterhouse workers are treated, how farm workers are treated, how the food is grown, what the impact is on the environment. And so there were so many different, so many questions. And, you know, it really took me a while. A mentor of mine at UC Berkeley quoted Maria Rerana Rilke, and he basically said, you know, love the questions themselves. And that's really how this book emerged, is my attempt to really bring up all the key questions and have the reader join me on a journey to answer this question, because it's really not an easy question to answer. And that really became the heart of the book, is these questions.
Yeah. We should mention that the book's title is The Good Eater, and that comes from a source you quote in your book. But, I mean, I liked the subtitle better, A Vegan Search for the Future of Food. Isn't that something we all want to know, though?
It is. I mean, the future of food is such a central part of our lives, and yet it's something that we don't, most of us actually don't put, of course you do and I do, but we put a lot, most of us don't put that much thought into how we eat. You know, we really just kind of go about our day, there are all these psychological and cultural aspects of eating that influence what we eat. And what I'm trying to do in this book is to get readers and eaters to really start asking questions and becoming more conscious about how their food actually ends up on their plate. And so, you know, this book really, it has been my own personal journey to understand what the future of food entails. And I want readers to go on that journey with me and ask these hard questions. And what I'm hoping, especially with the climate crisis and the fact that yeah. we're going to be forced to think differently about our food choices in the future, I really want people to actually realize that, you know, things are really going to shift in the future. And I want them to kind of start asking these questions now.
Yeah, well, this is, of course, you introduce all these issues. And I was going to ask you, why is everybody suddenly so interested in vegetarianism and veganism? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're touching on, I mean, climate change is at the forefront of everybody's mind at this point, or should be. And I guess it's not really, but it should be. And that's a start. Mm-hmm.
That's right. It's only in the last kind of 50 to 70 years that it's become part of the public consciousness. But, you know, as I mentioned, this movement has a very long history. So there have been cycles throughout history of kind of philosophical and especially moral reasons for not eating animals. But I think in the last 50 to 70 years, there's this raising of consciousness around the environment and the planet. And of course, also with the rise of factory farming, the ethical issue has become much more central. And really what I argue in the book is that veganism transformed in the last 5 to 10 years, what you're saying about all these books and cookbooks rising around veganism. In the last 5 to 10 years, it's really transformed from a niche subculture into a mainstream movement. And it's really gone from more of a moral movement that was, you know, what we'd call animal rights, the fight for the rights of animals, to veganism, which is about behavioral change. And it's really become more of a lifestyle movement. So people do it for, you know, environmental and ethical reasons, but many people also do it for health reasons. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I also was inspired. I mentioned in the book how my grandfather died quite prematurely from chronic disease, and losing him was really devastating, but it also did, it inspired me to look at the link between diet and disease, and I was absolutely astonished at what I found. I had no idea that, you know, for so long, nutritional research has shown that a plant-based diet or majority plant-based diet actually can reverse chronic disease, and having grown up in a family with a lot of chronic disease, you know, I just thought these are genetic, you know, genetic factors, and it's been incredible, actually, my entire family now follows a plant-based diet. My mom had prediabetes, which is completely reversed. And so I know that I'm able to live a more healthful life as well. So, you know, what we eat really is the most profound relationship that we can have with our own bodies, with the earth, with the beings that we share it with, and even with other people. And the way that we're eating today, which is the standard American diet, very heavy on meat, dairy, and eggs, and also on processed and basically junk foods, that diet, which seems like, you know, what's wrong with having bacon in the morning and eggs and turkey for lunch and fish for dinner, but really behind that food that's on your plate, there's this whole food system that we're not aware of, and it's actually obscured by design. And so that's what I talk about in the book and try to raise readers' consciousness around all of that.
Yeah, I was we interviewed a woman who wrote a book. Was she a doctor? I can't remember. But anyhow, she was Indian, and her husband had severe diabetes and mm-hmm. was on insulin. And she, mm-hmm. I didn't know until we interviewed her that India is like the leading country for diabetes. I mean, I don't know.
It was very probably, high, very high.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, but she changed its diet, and he didn't even have to do the insulin daily.
That's right. Type 2 diabetes is reversible through a low-fat, whole foods, plant-based diet. India, even though it's historically a vegetarian country, you know, the notion of ahimsa, nonviolence, comes from Hindu philosophy. But Unfortunately, today, India, like many other industrializing countries, is adopting a Western diet, and dairy has always been very central, and then a very high oil diet as well. So it's really incredible when you actually realize how much power you have to affect your health through diet. So that's something I also talk about. You know, often when people ask me, you know, but what about a Mediterranean diet? What about a paleo diet? Like, why is vegan healthy? And I always say, you know, with those diets, it's less what's in the diet and actually more about what's not in the diet. So even though paleo advocates will eat meat, they'll usually eat better quality meat. And also, more importantly, they're taking out a lot of processed foods from their diet. And the Mediterranean diet is not so much about it's healthy because it has olive oil. It's healthy because it actually doesn't have butter or as much meat. You know, it's it has more fruits and vegetables, grains and legumes, which are really, I think, nutritional research has shown for so long, no matter what the specific diet that we follow, typically the most healthy diets are the ones that have, you know, an abundance of fruits, vegetables, legumes, and grains.
Yeah, well, you live in a perfect spot for being vegan.
I do.
Not everybody does. What do you do about that?
It's a really good point, you know, because I live in the Bay Area now, which is, I mean, it was this Mediterranean climate and it's farmers markets all year round. It's an incredible place to eat. And I find myself, as I say in the book, very lucky to have ended up here through life circumstances. But, you know, and this is obviously the land of what I would call the conscious omnivores, the people who are interested in regenerative agriculture, grass-fed beef. My mentor, Michael Pollan, of course, lives here. Alice Waters, the founder of Chez Panisse. So it's this incredible landscape of food. But I will say, you know, I grew up in Toronto. I've lived in Boston. I've lived in Paris. I've lived in Tel Aviv. I lived in different places which weren't always, you know, warm all year round. And I have always been a member of a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. So I would always order from local farms as much as I could. I would go to the farmers markets when they were open throughout the year. And I would kind of go out of my way. And I was also on a student budget. But I really just prioritized buying good quality food rather than, let's say, buying alcohol or buying clothing or things like that. So I really made choices about prioritizing this because I thought of it as a long-term investment in my health and well-being and also that of my community. So food is really expensive. I want to be cognizant and conscious of that. And food access is a really big issue in this country and around the world. There are people who live in neighborhoods where they literally can't walk to a grocery store with fruits and vegetables. That's a huge systemic and structural problem. There's also linked historically to racism, another really big social issue. So I want to be really mindful of that. I will say for those of us who do have access to good food, though, I also feel like we have a duty and a kind of moral obligation to choose food that, you know, is more conscious of others as well. And if we put meat, dairy, and eggs on our plate 3 times a day, what we're doing is actually making it less possible for others to have food because essentially those products are only possible because we grow monoculture fields of corn, soy, and wheat that we feed to animals, and their caloric potential is lost in that process, and then we eat these heavily subsidized foods that actually don't even, like the cost of these, like the dozen eggs that's $1.99, that does not include the externalized costs. It doesn't include the cost on human well-being, animal well-being. So it's not a true economic reflector of how much that actually costs. And we actually have enough food in this country and around the world to feed everyone, but there is a lot of inequality in terms of distribution because we will clear the Amazon forest to plant fields of soy, not for vegans, but for farmed animals. And we'll import that soy and we'll feed it to animals. So there's something really deeply wrong with that system. But as I say, even veganism is not a silver bullet because, you know, if you're eating like bananas and mangoes farmed elsewhere around the world and you're eating that all year round, that's not something that's local to your community. So as I say, I am vegan for moral philosophical reasons, but I also believe that that's not, I try not to be a kind of preachy vegan in the sense that I see the problems also with the food system writ large. So it's not, you know, it's a be all and end all solution. But I do think it is a very significant step in the right direction.
One of the things I found interesting and often reads me the books that she's involved with, and this is certainly one of them. But one of the intriguing things about your book is that you discovered there were a lot of presumably really well-educated, generally oriented in the right direction, famous people
mm-hmm.
making sure that they themselves have a vegetarian diet.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything you concluded about that kind of situation?
Are you referring to like Michael Pollan or others who follow more of a plant-based diet now?
I particularly was intrigued by Leo Tolstoy.
Oh, yes, historical figures. Yes, exactly. That was actually a really fascinating chapter to research, the kind of ancient lineage of this movement. So we often think of veganism as this modern thing, or we think of it maybe as coming from the 1970s with the animal rights movement. And actually, historically, one of the most, well, of course, I mean, vegetarianism is a part of many Eastern philosophies, so
yes,
there were many,
right.
you know, many ancient cultures that have really chose to avoid animal products for moral and philosophical reasons. But what was interesting is to learn about the Western history as well, and that there are these icons of Western history that we don't typically think of as, you know, icons on veganism or vegetarianism. And one of them is Pythagoras, who is a philosopher and was inspired by his mentors, who believed that consciousness survives death and that consciousness moves from a human body into an animal body and vice versa. So he was actually also a proponent of, I would call him a modern day feminist, because he allowed women in his school, so he was quite progressive for his
right.
time. And then moving into Leonardo da Vinci and the Renaissance, we think of him as a mathematician, an inventor. We don't think of him as a vegetarian, but he very much was. He would free caged birds at the market, and he would avoid eating flesh. And then all the way to Leo Tolstoy, Gandhi, all these modern writers and others who and political activists that we really admire, but we don't think about, you know, this philosophy as being central to their lives. And that's something that I would really love for people to realize, is that people that they otherwise really look up to historically were actually big proponents of this movement as well.
Now, GBH was a puzzler.
GBH?
George Bernard Shaw.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, he was as well.
It's really funny.
There were others as well.
You go into the British Museum Library, and there is this clearly very old man with very old features, and it turns out that not only did he write a lot of plays, but he also ate a lot of vegetables.
He did, yes, he did. I know, it's actually remarkable when you look at the history, how many, you know, well-known people. For me, I was inspired by Tolstoy, who, you know, having Russian heritage, I read when I was a teenager, and he was a complicated person, but he, you know, vegetarianism ended up being, even though he himself never quite lived up to his own ideals, he really thought of vegetarianism as foundational to progressivism in general, and he was a pacifist as well, and he wrote very compellingly and graphically also about what it's like to visit a slaughterhouse and what actually happens, and of course the, you know, famous Paul McCartney quote, another famous vegetarian of the
old, yeah, right. Well,
who said if slaughterhouse
was influenced by his wife a lot, yeah,
he was and he wrote. That's right. And he wrote, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everybody would be vegetarian. So many icons of our culture, and even today, I mean, many musicians, artists, athletes are actually following a plant-based diet. In particular, also in the African diaspora, which I talk about in the book, I have a whole chapter around that. A lot of proponents of a lot of activists in the civil rights movement also saw
right.
a link between violence against animals and violence against humans. And so there's this also really fascinating radical history of veganism as central in many kind of historical movements as well, and feminism as well.
Yeah, especially feminism. I know a lot of. I did a whole bunch of activities with women in the arts and found a lot of veganism in that group.
Right.
Right. Yeah. A friend of mine, he's unfortunately no longer with us, but he was a brilliant architect. He was born in South Africa, raised in the UK, very talented planner and architect. And he said that what converted him to veganism was having a London flat across from an abattoir.
Oh, wow. That's quite graphic.
And it reminded me of, I happily cooked lobster my whole life, you know, when I lived closer to the shore. And I read that Considered the Lobster in Gourmet magazine at one point. Somebody sent me lobsters, live lobsters, and I opened the box and they kind of waved at me, and I had the worst time trying to cook those things.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting that you said that.
Will you emphasize that? It's not a matter of a power of reasoning or communication.
Mm-hmm.
It's feeling. Do they feel pain? Do they feel anything like that?
No,
separate that out nicely.
Let's hear it for the carrots.
Peter's, I've read in that section where you talk about that if you harvest vegetables even, some people are opposed to that because once you do that, the vegetable dies, right?
Right.
Peter's theory is that if you pull a carrot out of the ground, it screams. It doesn't leave you a lot to eat.
No, I know. But I think, you know, it's interesting because people will have debates on this, like, can plants feel pain? Like, do plants have consciousness? And I mean, I just want to say quickly that slaughterhouses, as you say, used to be in cities and towns. Now they're not. They're on the outskirts, right? So we don't have a clear line to that. We don't see this every day. We don't see animal cruelty
right.
as part of our day. We just see the kind of disembodied endpoint,
right.
which is like there are body parts in stores that we don't even think of them as body parts because of that kind of, as they say, it's kind of the last socially accepted, I would call it a moral atrocity that we don't have consciousness around this. But we are, you know, as Michael Pollan and others point out, we are omnivores. We're capable of digesting many forms of food, and meat has been a big part of our evolutionary history. And, you know, it has essential nutrients as well. But, you know, ultimately we have to eat something. What's interesting is that humans actually not only can survive on but thrive on a plant-based diet. And, you know, it's possible that plants also have some forms of consciousness, but I think that ultimately we have to make choices. And,
yeah.
you know, people ask me, like, are you against all meat? And I will say, you know, I think one thing we can all agree on, whether we're vegan or not, is the problem with factory farming. And that's where, you know, often the people who are proponents of regenerative agriculture or grass-fed beef, they'll have a lot of issues with veganism because they think, like, you know, that they have nothing in common. But in fact, both sides, many in the food movement, would all agree that factory farming is the big problem. And it's really, you know, the large-scale industrial production and commodification of animals is the thing that I really want everyone to talk about. I think sometimes on the fringe, there's debates about how much or what kind or should we even eat plants. And I think those are kind of interesting philosophically, but I think the bigger question is really this large-scale problem, and I really want people to focus on that and realize that we all can agree that vast reduction of meat, dairy, and eggs is the way to go, whether or not we're vegan.
Now, can I make you feel guilty? What are you putting on your table tonight? We will be honest and say on our table will be a duck from Canada, probably.
Yeah. Well, you know, meat, as they say in the book,
what's your excuse?
Meat is such a central part of our culture. I understand that it's really hard for people, especially if they've been eating it their whole lives. It's just we have all these psychological and sociological factors that reinforce meat eating. There's actually a term for this in psychology. It's the meat paradox. It's the idea that you can be fully aware of how the metaphoric, you know, or the proverbial sausage comes to your plate from the factory, but people don't necessarily want to see that, and there's a kind of cognitive dissonance at work, which is this idea that we can understand something intellectually but not want to kind of see it in our own lives and how it actually operates in our lives. And it's a fascinating thing to write about.
Michael Pollan gets
also
into that with the chicken slashing the throats of the chickens. He gets into that.
Right.
And a fellow food writer tried to replicate that, his experience, by going to a chicken farm and asking to actually participate in this, and it was not good. It was not good at all for
her. My opinion is, if you want to eat meat, I think this is what Michael Pollan was trying to get at in his book, that if you want to eat meat, you should experience what it's actually like to take a life, because that is what we're doing, and instead we're getting other people to do that for us, so we're completely disconnected with the philosophical and moral significance of what it is to take a life. Personally, I just feel like I just don't want to participate. And as I say, like, for me, living in alignment with my own values, I've never felt more kind of at peace in a way, spiritually, and not participating in that. But I also know that it is. I mean, Wendell Berry, who's a poet, you know, and a farmer and a novelist, he writes famously that eating is an agricultural act, certainly is. It's also political and social, environmental. But I also say that eating is a spiritual act as well. And when you choose to eat something, you are participating in the entire food chain that made it possible for it to be on your plate. And personally, for me, there's a kind of spiritual significance in choosing to not participate in violence if I can, especially if it's actually good for my health and actually good for the environment. So for me, that's how I choose to eat. And I still think, like, if people want to eat meat once a week or once a month, I think that there's room for that. But I just really argue against this ever presence of meat, dairy, and eggs in our lives and us thinking that this is somehow normal, even though it is absolutely a reversal of history. Historically, before 50, 70 years ago, we were eating, you know, as I always say in the book, the future of food, I hope, is in a way a reversal to the past of food, where plants, not animals, were at the center of our plates, and meat and other animal products really were.
Tell our listeners your theory about something that bothers me a lot. I'm going to preface this. I have a cousin who's vegan, and I she was coming. We were doing Thanksgiving, and she wanted me to get this turkey. Well, I mean, it was vegetarian. It was not real
tofurkey.
Turkey, but it
tofurkey
was made to look like a slice of turkey. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I don't approve of that. I mean, nobody cares whether I approve of it or not. But there's something wrong with this pretending thing. It's like another friend of mine was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she and her husband had non-alcoholic beer that looked just like a can of beer. Mm-hmm. That she would drink. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's something just basically, I don't even know the term. It's lying, it's cheating, having to do that. And why is that a way out? I mean, I'm even worried about, you start addressing, I'd like you to address this. You start addressing this, this manufactured stuff like cell-grown meat and stuff like that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What? Yeah, I mean, I don't like that either.
No, I hear you. And as I say in the book, I'm personally someone who doesn't include that on my plate. The reason I think that people want to participate or have products like that, like I think probably this person you're talking about brought tofurkey. That's like a famous turkey-like thing that's made that's vegan, actually. But it's because culture is so central to our lives. And in a way, when we give up you know, someone's turkey on Thanksgiving, we feel like we're giving up an entire culture that we're part of. So I think these products, in a way, say you can still participate in this culture by having this alternative, and it's usually made from like wheat or soy, or as you say, these new modern products like Beyond Meat, whose factory I headquarters and factory I visited. They're creating a replacement product, not just for the kind of nutritional aspect of meat, but the sensory, cultural, and like visceral, subjective experience of eating meat. And, you know, in the book, I refer to these solutions, which, by the way, are very old, like, you know, ancient. So even in ancient China or India, there were like replacement type products, is that they didn't quite look like meat. I think the food technology today is making it more possible for them to look, kind of look and taste and feel like meat more. But I call them sort of absurd solutions to absurd problems, because the product itself, I mean, it's kind of strange to take plants like wheat or peas or soy and turn them into something that looks like an animal part. Like, that's a really bizarre thing if you think about it, you know? But the problems that they're trying to solve are also absurd, in that, like, right now we claim that the meat that we eat is like just one ingredient. It's one ingredient in the store, but really it's not. It's chock full of hormones. It's been raised in factory farming. It's been, once the meat is slaughtered, it's like doused in chemicals to try to retain freshness. So these are not natural either. So in a way, they're both kind of not natural. That's why I personally advocate for really filling your plate with, right, you know, delicious like beans and legumes and lentils, and making something you can bring to Thanksgiving. That, like, one of my signature dishes for Thanksgiving is, I really love like carving out a squash and then just like filling it with delicious like stuffing that's, you know, just like rice and things like that.
Right.
So it's, in a way, it's a kind of a play on the idea of like stuffing something, but it's
yeah,
very much like a whole foods thing rather than trying to make it look like turkey. So I think these items are, you know, I think they should be thought of as a transition food for those who really just can't give up the taste and the experience of meat. But ultimately, I hope people can just learn to cook vegetables, because the plant kingdom is so abundant. It's full of delicious foods, and I just wish people got a little more creative with that.
Right. Well, there are some really extraordinary. One of our vegan restaurants here is always a beard finalist, you know, and there's...
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Beautiful.
And, unusual. I mean, but anyhow, I wanted to jump to, like, way in the future. So we interviewed Hervé Teese, molecular gastronomy guy. And, he bragged about how he and what was the chef? I can't remember. Also in Paris,
Pierre Gagnier
did a dinner in Tokyo or someplace, and they had this very elaborate. It was very expensive dinner, very elaborate menu, and all of it was chemicals. You see?
Wow.
And how do we avoid getting that kind of thing going? They're already doing this.
That's not my future food. It's not my chosen future food.
No.
But that's
where the money is. And that's a good motivator for just about half of what everybody does is money. The bottom
absolutely.
Line.
Absolutely. And Marion Nussle, who wrote that phenomenal book, Food Politics, talks about this too, food industry.
She's an incredible woman, yeah.
She's incredible woman.
Not all that likable, though. I mean, I wonder if the personality doesn't affect her influence.
Marion, we hope you're not listening.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, she blurred my book, and I felt so honored, because I really respect her, and I really respect her opinion. So I'm really grateful. But she writes in the book that, like, the food industry, the way that they make money is by essentially arguing, like, eat more. You need to eat more of this or that. Or, you know, it's funny, you know, people ask me, do you love, like, high-end restaurants? And I actually actually don't really, because I often find that they turn food into a kind of like sensory experience rather than really it being about like nourishing and nurturing, you know. And so personally, I eat very simply, and I actually really enjoy that. And the molecular gastronomy, I think it's a kind of form of art and experimentation, you know, art meets science, but I don't think it's really an argument about a true future of food. That being said, I do think like food science is going to be part of our future. I mean, already, you know, these companies that are, especially in the precision fermentation space, they are manufacturing yeasts and other proteins and things that right now, you know, we engineer the rennet in cheese and things like that. So I do think there is a role for food technology, but I just wish that, you know, I wish that we would really have more serious conversations about how we can actually scale a system of farming that is climate conscious and actually is going to make it possible for more people to have access to better quality local food, and that we really make choices as a society around how we want to use our land, instead of like many golf courses or parking lots or like uses of land that are not necessarily helpful in terms of like feeding more people. I think actually having those kinds of conversations, like really large scale systemic change, where we build a food system that isn't based on the values of the fast food system that it is right now, which is uniformity, cheapness, and convenience. And instead, it's about regeneration and health and the health and well-being of communities, and really, you know, like an investment in long-term health. Because right now, the incentives are completely the opposite. The incentives are to actually make more food that makes people more sick, because, you know, less healthy people means more money for the health industry, like pharmaceutical industry, and so on. It's all very tied together. And honestly, when I was
like this, I think the same is true about this. What's the name of that? Ozempic stuff. Everybody's viewing this as great solution for obesity, when in fact, what it's going to do is end up making people sicker, and doctors could
save
for even prescribing it.
It's the embodiment of a silver bullet solution, which is exactly what I'm trying to argue against in the book. And you know, the book is not, it's not, I think it's written in an approachable way, but the topics are actually pretty dense and pretty heavy. And I think that, you know, there isn't a silver bullet, unfortunately. And I think, like, these miracle drugs or these miracle foods, I think they really belie this much more complex and difficult questions that we have to ask, and that's really what I wanted to write about.
Well, Nina, this sort of sounds to me, it feels like it's just the start of a conversation. We could go on for a long time with
it. It does.
listeners, again, it's called The Good Eater, and just please get it and read it, because it's going to help you understand what the future is that you're looking at, and your grandchildren particularly are looking at. Nina Gilbo, it was beautiful talking to you, and thank you so much for your book.
Thank you so much for your kind words and your support of the book. It really means the world to me, and I appreciate you sharing it with your listeners.
Well, we'll do it again next book.
I would love to.
Thank you.
I would love to. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Listeners, I will start by saying I love this next book and guest, the author, Yasmin Farr. The book is called Cook Simply, Live Fully, and it's a philosophy that I can get very close to. I love it. And the book is it's just so packed with information. Our big challenge is to get through what we want to say about it all. Welcome, Yasmin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are you in New York now, or where are you?
No, I'm actually in Menorca in Spain.
Oh, right. So the plan worked, huh?
Yes, it did work out. It took me a couple of years, but I got here eventually.
No, I missed that. Where are you?
She's in Menorca.
Oh, you are in Menorca.
That's why I said she made it.
Right. So, I've never been. Is it very different from mainland Spain and Mallorca?
I mean, it has its own feel and like pace of life. Like, it's very slow and more flat than Mallorca, but it's great. I mean, I think all of Spain is beautiful, and this isn't an exception.
Yeah, we were in Ibiza, if you remember.
Yeah,
right. Our cousin got married in Ibiza.
Relative of mine, living in London, got to made sure that many of her relatives went, because they told their potential guests, Anne and Peter are coming. What's your excuse for not being there?
Okay, well, let's, are you ready to start the interview? Let's get it started, because there's so much to cover.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Go ahead, Robin.
We're going ahead?
Yes, please.
Well, we did establish already that our guest is from a somewhat unusual part of the world, shall we say.
Did you start the recording, Rabbit?
Yes. I believe I have been recording. I believe I've been recording for about 5 minutes.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Okay.
That's all right. You knew we'd already started, didn't you, dear?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and you knew that we'd start.
Oh, yeah. I think I heard the recording go on, and yeah. I thought we were recording. But it worked either way.
Well, there's so many things, so many aspects of this book to talk about. To start off with, I mean, the things you really love fully. You say live fully, but you love fully, too. I mean, like citrus. You have citrus, and it's about everything. I love citrus, too. You also love broccolini. There are very definite favorites. Chicken thighs, I cook them all the time. Yeah. So, but how did you develop your cooking style? I mean, you were raised on Persian cuisine, which is probably one of the great cuisines of the world.
I think so, too. I mean, I love it. But I think, fortunately, Persian cuisine takes a lot of time, and it doesn't really work as well for, like, quick weeknight meals, which is more of what I've been doing. But I think that plus traveling a lot has given me, like, a very high standard of food, of, like, what I expect to eat. But I think I'm also a little bit lazy, so I try to make recipes as quick and as easy as possible, but still have that, like, wonderful full flavor with, like, bright notes from citrus and full of vegetables and really good ingredients. So I think it's drawing on all of my life experiences a little bit.
Yeah, well, you moved around quite a bit, but we kind of share that. I picked up and took off to bum around the South Pacific at one point.
I found out
you had to have a specialty. You know, you could just bum. But you do love doing things where you meet people unexpectedly and get very involved in their particular point of view and interest, which I found rather stimulating. Like, you would sit at a bar, you're not at a bar, but I mean, you'd sit next to strangers and get into conversations with them. You say you don't mind eating alone because you get to meet new people.
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite things to do, especially when you're sitting at, like, a restaurant bar. I've had some of the most interesting conversations with people. We've ended up sharing meals, and I learn, you know, where they came from, what their perspectives are, and it's been illuminating, honestly. And it's just so much fun to meet new people, especially when you're traveling.
Right. Yeah, I like that, too. That's my favorite part of traveling, actually.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us a little bit about how you organize this book. I thought that was kind of interesting. We get so many cookbooks, and none of them is organized the way you've organized yours.
Oh, thanks. Yes, it was organized by the energy you have to cook dinner and your mood. So there's lap dinners, which are like come together in 15, 20 minutes. There's no prep work. It's for when you're really exhausted. And then there's coffee table dinners, which is more your average weeknight meal and like meant to be when you eat, you know, at a coffee table. And then there's at the dinner table when you have a little bit more energy, you know, maybe and are sitting at the table. So I find that's how I found myself eating and deciding what to cook. So I set up the book that way.
Yeah, well, now you have a lot of formal training in cooking and flavor profiling and that sort of thing. And you've done all kinds of food writing. So you've been at this a while. How long have you been doing this?
I've been very lucky in my career to have worked with so many great editors and so many great publications. So I've been doing this for about almost 15 years, I think. So it's definitely an accumulation of all the things that I've learned and places that I've worked, you know, like Food and Wine magazine or for Forbes Travel Guide and now New York Times Cooking. So, and I've had so many great editors who have really taught me so much, too.
Right. Were you just set about, I mean, you did this book pretty much during the pandemic, right? Or at least?
No, I did it a bit after. I think during the pandemic is when I first visited Menorca. Like, I mean, towards the later end of it when we were allowed to travel and things. And that's when I fell in love with the island and decided to leave New York and change my life. So I guess it was sort of the tail end of the pandemic, if you will.
Uh-huh. Right. Were you taking the time to organize your experiences into this book, or were you also exploring new directions and new attitudes towards cooking and food?
Yeah, definitely exploring new ones. Like I think I went in with a plan, and then as I started working on it, you know, so much of my life ended up changing, and it was a really transitional period, and it ended up shaping the tone of the book, you know, having this flexibility and cooking by your mood and energy level, and I think just the ingredients I used were all really influenced by what I was going through and where I was traveling.
Right. You have a section on how to use this book to make your life easier, which is kind of an eye-opener. Tell us a little bit about how you decide what you're going to be cooking.
I mean, I think this section is really meant to tell you what's in the book and how you're feeling. So I think I really wanted people to take a second, think about like how they're feeling, how they want to feel after they eat, you know, whether it's they want something comforting or nourishing or something really light and bright. And I find the weather sort of affects me in that decision. And so that's really what I want people to think about, like being present kind of in this moment and figuring out what they need. And then there's also some tools and tips, but they're really minimal tools. It's a very like, low-tech cookbook.
Yeah, and I like that. I mean, I got so tired of people telling me I need an air fryer.
Oh, exactly. Let's face for all these things, you know?
You have a like guidelines under this chapter called Some Things to Know as You Flip Through. And tell us what some of those are.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, they're very useful, I think. One of the big deficits in a lot of these cookbooks that we get is they don't have a general guide of how, I mean, overall, to actually use the book.
I agree. Yeah, so in this one, every oven recipe is set at 400 degrees, so that way you can easily, like, mix and match and swap things around. There's also this, like, vegetable cooking chart that tells you, like, the basic cooking times for all the vegetables found in the book. And there's a wine pairing chart, which you can use, like, the main ingredients in the recipes and then match them with the wine suggestion, which my friend is a sommelier wrote. And there's also, this is one of my favorite parts, there's a magenta ruler that's on the spine of the book.
Oh, yeah, I wanted you to explain that. That's very cool.
Yeah, thanks. So when I'm developing recipes, you know, I have this magenta ruler that I think I bought at CVS like 5 to 10 years ago, and I use it to make sure, you know, like my 2-inch piece of ginger is 2 inches or things are cut into a 1/2-inch piece. So I thought it would be helpful for readers to also have that. So you can easily, like, you know, take your ginger or take your piece of carrot or whatever it is and match it up to the spine or also inside the book. So just like little things to make cooking easier for people.
Right. Now, I mean, I think that, one of the outstanding benefits of this book is that you have like sections that you don't usually see in cookbooks, like some fun seasoning ideas. I thought that was fascinating. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I think in this vegetable chart, even if it's like basic cooking methods, like once you master that, then you can play around with it a lot. So the idea of that is just different spices, different compound butters, things that you can add to everyday vegetables just to make it feel a little different, because I feel like we all get in ruts where we cook the same thing over and over. So it's nice just to have some new fun ideas.
Right. What are some of your most favorite things? I said chicken. I said citrus. And you also have some other favorite things to always have on hand to cook with.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about some of those?
So I use a spiced cumin a lot, which I know some people may not love, but I think it's a really great ingredient to help like layer.
Yeah, I thought that was very bold, by the way. So many people don't like it, and you just dove right into it.
Did it. I know. My agent and I were joking, well, if you don't like cumin, this might not be the book for you. But I think it's so, you know, because it's not used like in such a bold way. Like I think if used in small amounts too, just adds like a great depth to recipes, especially when combined with other spices and ingredients. But I use like turmeric as well, red chili flakes.
There's a book on spices called Spice Heroes, and that was the first one that was was singled out for absolutely the biggest hero of spicing.
Yeah.
And I found myself putting it in everything.
Exactly.
I put it in green tea. Green tea with black pepper, which activates the turmeric. It's fabulous.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so good. And I think, I only use 6 spices in the book because I think there's so much you can do with those 6 by combining them in different ways. So it's simple, but it's also deeply flavorful.
Yeah, why don't you just list what those spices are that you use over and over again?
Oh, of course. So there's cumin, of course, dried oregano, paprika, sumac, and turmeric. And of course, salt and pepper and red pepper flakes.
Yeah, you know the paprika. I interviewed at one time mentioned that it was great to add to like collard greens or anything else where you wanted to have a ham flavor and you don't happen to have a ham shank lying around.
Yeah, if you're using smoked paprika, 100%.
Yeah, pimenton.
Exactly, on pasta, on chicken, and just using a tiny bit gives it so much color and so much flavor.
Right. Yeah, that's one of my essential ones, come to think of it.
Yeah. I think we all have our favorites, too, like the ones we finish quickly before everything else, but these ones are mine.
Right. This is a useful guide, this vegetable cooking chart, because a lot of times people shy away from vegetables that they're not super familiar with. And you take the guesswork out of it.
Exactly. And I think there are nights when you're tired and you just don't want to think. So it's like, okay, how long do I cook carrots for? How long do I cook bok choy for? And just give you really simple ways to do it. Plus those fun seasoning ideas so you can make it different too.
Right. Well, you have a lot of these charts and guidelines in here, but the recipes themselves, did you develop all of them yourself?
Yeah.
Or you built on?
All the recipes are mine. The wine chart was written by a sommelier friend of mine, though. So I came up with different ingredients, and then she would match them. So that was written by someone else, but everything else is me.
The other thing you use over and over again that I'm really fond of, and people don't, it's one of those underused things, is white miso.
Yes, I love it. I think it's, I mean, in salad dressings, in marinades, like in soups, like it just adds so much. So I think it's something, yeah, that people, because it also can keep in your fridge for so long. So even if you don't think you're going to use it every day, it'll last, and you just might, you never know.
Now, you start out with very simple, easy recipes that for when you're low energy. Is that correct?
Yep, exactly. That's lap dinners.
And then you move on. But even in your fancy section,
oh, yeah,
with at the table, you don't get overly precious with these, which is another big gripe of mine.
No. I think everything, honestly, is very simple and easy. Like even the, like you said, fancy at the dinner table is really accessible, and you could do it on a weeknight. Like nothing is more than an hour and a half. It's just that sometimes I might ask you to like use another bowl or make, you know, or do a marinade for a little bit longer. So it's like we'll need a little bit more time, but it's not anything crazy.
And the other thing I like is you have recipes which you can combine to make it like a more special and important dinner to present.
Exactly. And I think, well, and also in the book, there's a lot of suggestions in recipes of, you know, this dish would go well with this one, or like there's a sides and salad section that can kind of add on to anything else in the book as well.
Yeah, that's very useful. I mean, and you do recommend, though, which is a good thing for people to note, to read the recipe all the way through before you start tackling it.
Exactly.
I learned that the hard way.
Yeah. No, and I think especially for new cooks, and then they're like, wait a minute, what's that step? What happens? And so I think it's so important to familiarize yourself with it, because then you know what's going to happen. Nothing's a surprise, and you might adjust it your way, you know? Yeah.
So, I didn't realize until I was reading in your book that people underutilize the broiler.
Yeah, a lot of people are really scared of the broiler, which I do understand because it's really intense heat, but it's so helpful for cooking, especially for like finishing chicken if you want to get an extra bit of color on it, for quickly cooking shrimp or vegetables, because it's like an upside-down grill, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, we actually had ours break down, and I realized how totally dependent we were on it.
Exactly. It's so helpful. Yeah.
So before we started this, I asked you what your ethnic food was, because you seem to have a preference, which I have, for bitter, for citrusy and bitter, both.
There's a lot of
sidelines. And I think that's kind of how you were raised, because that's how I was raised.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, and I think,
Go ahead.
Oh, no, because I think there's a lot of dried limes that are used in Persian cuisine, and, like, even sumac has, like, a lemony flavor. So I think a lot of that comes from my childhood. You're right, definitely influenced by that.
Well, you know, you said you have a friend who reads cookbooks. Didn't you say that?
I do.
Well,
I
do the same thing.
Do you? I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this one friend of mine who, she always had a weight issue, and she was always jealous that I got such satisfaction out of just reading the recipes and not even actually cooking all of them.
No, I mean, I think it's great, like, especially when cookbooks are full of stories and, like, things about the author or their life. Like, it's like a book. It's for people who love food, you know?
Uh-huh.
I think it's a great book. Yeah.
What do you think about besides the fact that you're casual with, and more relaxed, I guess is a better term, with the recipes and so on. You obviously are very personalized and personally invested in these recipes. What do you think are the outstanding qualities that you bring to it? You photograph very well, but your photographs all throughout the book, which is perfectly appropriate because the recipes have that flavor. You tell us by the same person with a particular bent and taste. What do you think, what recipes show your personality the most that you'd like to point out to the listeners?
Ooh, good question. So there's one in the book called Big Cockle Energy, which is like a funny name, but it's like frothy clams in them. It's like miso, soy sauce, and a little chili crisp. And the story behind it is I was at a restaurant with a friend, and we ended up befriending somebody else and had these amazing cockles and just, you know, after a few drinks, started calling things Big Cockle Energy. And I just think it's one of the recipes that shows kind of the fun approach to cooking, like how, A, we can learn so much in restaurants, but also just enjoy the process and sharing it with other people. And I think most of the recipes as well have this kind of lighthearted, fun tone to them, or that's what I want to come across. So I think that's a good one. And then, yeah, I mean, there are just so many, I would say. But I love them all, so I guess I'm a little biased.
Yeah. You have really some amazing chicken thigh recipes. You know, I hate to cite the source, but Mario Batali once said that the only point of chicken breast is you could get the thighs and throw away the feed the chicken breast to the dog or something like that.
Throw them to the dogs, he said.
Yeah. But I mean, I always get it, and I usually get it with skin on, bone in as well, like you do.
Yeah, I think that's so flavorful. And I think especially for like a weeknight or even for serving for friends, like they're so easy to make, they're so flavorful, and they're forgiving. So even if you leave them in 5 to 10 minutes too long, like they'll be okay. They'll still be delicious. Whereas breast,
and
really
they're good for leftover too, which is not a good thing.
God. Exactly. Yeah, they're just a good classic, I think.
No, what I can't remember is, do you do desserts in here? I don't remember.
You know, I don't do really desserts because I'm not really a big dessert person, truthfully.
No,
we're
not. Well, Peter, of course, is English, and he has an insatiable sweet tooth. but we never bothered much with desserts.
Really eat them, so it's never been something that's been fun for me to cook. I've always been more savory.
Now, how do you keep up with, you're traveling so much, how do you keep up with your writing and exploring the different recipes and so forth? You must be really stressed, actually.
You know, it's funny, I think in the beginning I definitely was, but I actually got used to it because I was like an undercover hotel and restaurant inspector for 4 years, so I just learned to get used to that pace of always being on the road and working remotely, whether like from a hotel bed or in a cafe, so I can still make myself focus. And then even when writing this book, I was bouncing around different Airbnbs, so I really like whittled down my knife kit to only the essentials and kind of learned to navigate different stovetops and ovens and all these things. So it definitely takes a moment to adjust, but I think once you get used to it, you know how to handle a bit and not get too stressed out. And I think the change is kind of good, too, or I like it.
You introduce some fruit, rarely, but you do introduce some. I'm looking at the chicken with the grapes. And I found that if you put grapes in anything, they think it's much fancier than it is.
I know. I completely agree. Like, a friend made this, and she was like, wow, everyone thought it was so fancy and elegant, and really, it's like a chic pan meal. You know? Like, there's nothing really done to it. But it works. Yeah. I think they're so beautiful and colorful, too. You know, like,
they are pretty, aren't they?
Yeah. They're gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. You like pasta a lot.
I do. I love pasta. It's just so comforting.
Mm-hmm. You don't bother with making fresh pasta, do you?
I don't. I mean, maybe every once in a while, but like I said, I don't say lazy because that sounds bad, but I think there's a lot of high-quality pasta. I'll buy fresh pasta, but usually it's just something I do for quick meals rather than something more luxuriating, you know?
Yeah. Could you explain to me, I mean, I know essentially what ghee is, but you're really gaga over ghee. And I mean, how is it different from if you, what is the term when you take regular butter and
the whey? Yeah, I mean, it is a type of like clarified butter, but you can use
clarified the word I was talking about.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Cooking. Yeah, it has a high cooking point, and it's really good for people who have problems with dairy, so they can usually digest that as well. And it just has this, like, wonderful nutty flavor, like, especially when you mix it with miso. Oh, my God. It's one of my favorite things. Like, it smells unbelievable and just tastes so rich, too.
Huh. See, I've never really experimented much with that. In fact, we use almost solely olive oil, I mean, basically.
Yeah, that's what I've seen mostly until someone introduced me to ghee, and then I've really become quite addicted to it.
Spanish cuisine, I mean, it's like, if you think of it, I mean, most, I would say that a lot of ingredients, like olive oil, think olive oil.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a source of olives to feed the world, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So, do you have an overlap with Spanish? I mean, are you interested in Spanish cuisine, per se?
Definitely. I mean, I think the more time I spend here, the more I've learned about it, and I've read some cookbooks, and, you know, I'm trying to learn more Spanish so I can read actual cookbooks, you know, in Spanish or eventually in Catalan. But, I think it's been really nice to learn more about it. And, like, I'm using more olives, more smoked paprika. Like, it's finding its way into my food, like more anchovies and things like that. So I think I'm someone who's like easily influenced by where I travel. So you'll see it in my recipe soon.
Yeah. Well, I was very impressed that you learned some Catalan.
Yeah, very slowly.
Do you remember, who was that chef and restaurateur that we interviewed who insisted on, I think it was in Barcelona. It would have been probably. He insisted on doing the whole interview in Catalan.
Yeah, it was Santi Santa Maria.
Santa Santa Maria, who's dead now, I guess. But
he had a place just outside Barcelona.
Oh,
and,
wow!
After he died, his wife took over running the B&B and the restaurant. And
oh, I forgot about that, yeah.
I think she probably cooked better than he did.
True. But we had a terrible time. I mean, I've never actually really formally studied Spanish, although, I mean, between French and Italian, I managed to get by. But Catalan, I mean, I couldn't. The only thing that was worse was the, what is the Basque language called?
Oh, yeah.
I can't even read that. But, we had native Spanish speakers that had a hard time translating from Catalan.
Yeah, I mean, it is different. I'm not sure if someone's saying it's like a little more similar to French than, but, or like a mashup. But it is different. I can't really read it, and I'm not an expert either of them. Just slowly learning.
Well, now, what is your next project? I'm always interested in how, because, I mean, this is coming to a conclusion with the book published, and as much as I've read, it's been very well received, and I loved it. Are you already thinking of your next project? I think cookbooks, I don't know why everybody wants to produce a cookbook. I think it's the most tedious thing I've ever had to do.
It's so much work. Honestly, every time I finish one, I'm like, I'm never doing this again. But then,
exactly.
Oh, but I love them. Like, it's so much work. Yeah, exactly. I don't really know. Next. Mm-hmm.
Oh, is your plan to stay where you are? And
I just got here a couple of months ago, so it's still very new. So I think whatever I do next will probably be inspired by this time here, but I think it's still kind of in that early phase of trying to figure it out and seeing what I get excited by. So maybe it'll be a cookbook, maybe it'll be like a food related book that's more writing. I really don't know. So no good answers. TBD.
Right. Well, is there something that we haven't covered that we should be pointing out to our listeners about this particular book?
I think you've asked some really great questions. Like, it's a book, you know, full of stories, but it's also meant to be really helpful in the kitchen. So something that's, like, used for every day, but also to inspire and, you know, have fun with, which I think, is really the hope.
Well, you don't realize how cookbooks fail in one regard. I mean, I learned from my granddaughter, who's 17, mm-hmm. That she loves cooking and food. She can follow all these cookbooks, but what none of them tell her is why.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And you do that. You tell why you do such and such, which is really very important, I think.
No, I think so, too, because also that's how people learn, and then that way they'll probably listen to you rather than think, I don't need to do that. Because giving them the why is like, okay, this is why I have to do it, you know? And I think having a visual cue also helps them in case, you know, their stovetop isn't that strong. So I think, you know, paying attention to what's actually happening in your pan and understanding why it's happening, you know, will just make you a better cook. And that's really my ultimate goal. Yeah.
Well, I really am enjoying your book and enjoyed. I knew I was going to enjoy talking to you because I feel there's a kinship here.
And
beyond broccolini, which I also enjoy.
So
and I'm going to investigate more sumac because I haven't really ever investigated that.
Oh, it's a good one. So it's great in dressings, like on meats, like as a marinade. There's one in the book with fish and salmon that's really good. It's like a mild lemony flavor and like a nice salt, like coarse texture. So it's great. Highly recommend.
Good. And listeners, I didn't get into this, but you're going to enjoy her directions for seasoning. She doesn't do like a half teaspoon or this or that and the other. She has you rotating the drizzle around the skillet. It's wonderful.
Exactly, like half moon, quarter moon.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, wonderful book. Again, Far, and it's Cook Simply, Live Fully. And you sound like you're doing both. So that's great. And thank you for talking to us.
Of course. Thank you both for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, good luck with your success with your book.
Thank you.
And enjoy your living fully. Enjoy it.
I will. You too. Thanks
okay.
so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Are you turning it off?